Jeremy in the back, okay?
Yes.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to chat again. I always enjoy this meeting. It's great to see so many familiar faces in a different context or different setting. One where I think people are looking simply to increase their knowledge about diabetes. It's very exciting. I've got one big problem this morning, and that is my talk is an hour, and I've only been given 25 minutes to do it. So it's really broken down into two parts. And when the doctors were getting together chatting about what to talk about, I had actually given a talk to a group of physicians here about 2 months ago about taking care of diabetes in the hospital. And I think that hospital care for diabetes is something that unfortunately has been neglected in a lot of fashions. It seemed that it would be a natural thing to bring the topic to this group and just try and expose you to a little bit of the data that's out there about hospital care and diabetes. Because it's an area of great interest and an area where there's been a lot of new science over the last 10 years. It's interesting, if you think back in the history of diabetes, you don't have to go back that far, but if you go back to about 1992 and think that you have diabetes in the outpatient world right now, 1992, it was thought that really, when we talked about blood sugar control, that all we really needed to do was keep people from having too low of blood sugar or so high that they went into ketoacidosis. And the thought that controlling blood sugar prevented complications of diabetes was brand new, and it had never been tested. And a study called the DCCT trial, which many of you have heard about, came out, which showed that controlling blood sugars to near normal prevented complications, eye problems, foot problems, maybe less so, heart problems, stroke. So we're just beginning to take that same kind of information and learn how to apply it to hospital patients. I've broken the talk into two main parts. So the first part is going to be a bunch of scientific data that looks at blood sugar and hospital and outcomes. And the second part is I've tried then to take that and put it into some practical recommendations to what can you, as somebody who has diabetes, do when you go into the hospital. Just wanted to put that up there to remind people that it's an informal talk. There should be some time for questions, hopefully at the end of the talk. And if not, there's a half hour at the end of the morning where the forum is open and you can ask all of the doctors questions as you see fit. Okay. Just some basic data. Let me see if I can get this to work with the mouse. About diabetes. We know that diabetes is actually the fourth most common cancer. It's listed as a discharge diagnosis in about 10 to 12% of all hospital cases. It's probably present in more, but it's not always listed. If we look at people who have cancer, We know that diabetes is actually the fourth most common condition that's seen in hospital patients. It's listed as a discharge diagnosis in about 10 to 12% of all hospital cases. It's probably present in more, but it's not always listed. If we look at people who have heart surgery, it's about a third of all heart surgery patients. And we know that people who have diabetes stay 1 to 3 extra days in the hospital for the same condition compared to those who don't have diabetes. This was really interesting. When I gave this talk, I hadn't run across this before. This simply shows healthcare expenditures for diabetes. And I apologize if you can't see, if it gets too small to see in the back. But I think what you can look at, if you just focus on those green bars, is the cost per person for diabetes each year. A little over $6,000 goes to hospital care, where if you look, it's about $2,200 for nursing home, a little under $2,000 to go see your doctor in the doctor's office, a little under $1,000 for prescriptions, and a little under $1,000 for insulin. So hospital costs are really the biggest cost that we incur as a nation for taking care of diabetes. What I'm going to show you is that high blood sugar is a risk factor for bad outcomes, for heart attacks, for worse outcomes after stroke, for complications after surgery. And I'm going to go through things pretty quickly. I felt like I had to put in one what we call pathophysiology slide. So why does high blood sugar or diabetes create problems? And this just shows a complex, really a complex diagram. On the left side, basically what we see is that high blood sugar changes the way the immune system functions. So there's increased inflammation and more risk of infection. If we look at the right side, we see that there's a stress in the system, something created called reactive oxygen species, free radicals, things that damage tissues are more prevalent when the blood sugar is high. And all of this leads to cellular injury, inflammation, tissue damage, and ultimately bad outcomes. If we look at data, I'll show you now probably three or four slides that look something like this. This is just on the bottom axis is the blood sugar, starting on the very left side, going from 80 to 99, and all the way on the right side up above 300. And it's the hospital mortality rate in people who were critically ill in the ICU. And what you can see is for those who have low blood sugars, about 10%, goes up to about 40% in those whose blood sugar was over 300 in the ICU. Another way to look at this is people who were admitted to the hospital for heart attacks. And again, you can see on the left, blood sugar is less than 100. Coming over to the right, blood sugar is above 200. The mortality rate for people admitted for heart attack goes up as the blood sugar goes up. This was really interesting. I wanted to spend a little time on this one because it brings up some interesting points and a surprising point. This is people who are going for angioplasty or stent placement for coronary heart disease. I don't know, are people even able to see the numbers in the back? I'm just curious. What it shows is the percentage of people who have restenosis. So you get your artery ballooned open and a stent's put in there, and how often does it close? So we'd like to see lower bars. And if we start on that very left bar, those are people who have a hemoglobin A1C less than 7, so good control of their average blood sugar, and on the morning of the intervention, their blood sugar was less than 135. If you come to the next bar, those whose A1C is above 7, but blood sugar is less than 135 on that day, have a slightly higher risk of stenosis, but not a whole lot bigger. But then jump over to the two on the right. On the left-hand side, here, this is an A1C less than 7 and a blood sugar above 135, and here an A1C above 7 and a blood sugar above 135. So that blood sugar on the day that you have the procedure really looks to be, from this study, more important than what your average blood sugar control is. That seems a little counterintuitive to me, but I think it's kind of thought-provoking.
It's over the pointers there by the computer.
Oh, okay. It's called the Dagami study. This was a study designed to test that hypothesis. They took people who were admitted for myocardial infarction or heart attack, and they said, well, what if we take those people and we either treat them with standard blood sugar control for the time? This was a study that was done in the mid-90s. So they got pill medications, they may have gotten insulin if their blood sugar was above 200, or they got intensive treatment, where they got insulin injections, typically 3 or 4 insulin injections per day. That was continued through the hospital and for 3 months afterward. And they followed this group of people for about 5 years. This just shows on the top what their blood sugars look like. They had blood sugars of about 280 when they started. 24 hours later, blood sugars of 170 for those that were in the intense group, and at discharge 150 in the intense group versus 211 24 hours later and 160 in the standard group. So these are numbers that, all of us would think we see them commonly in the hospital, but they're not necessarily great numbers. And if you look at the A1C on the bottom, they were about equal at 8% to start, It dropped to about 7% in the group that got the intense treatment versus 7.5%, and that was continued out for about a year. And then this is really the important slide. What you see are two graphs, the one on the left with the blue and the red. The blue is the group that got standard treatment. The red is the group that got the intense insulin. And it's the percentage of people who died during the study. And what you can see is that those who got the intensive insulin actually did better. And then if you come over to the right-hand side, they looked at a group specifically that had low-risk features. These were a slightly younger group. They didn't have heart failure. They had normal kidney function. And they'd never been on insulin. And the separation was even bigger. So it was about a 50% reduction in the risk of dying. A second study that I think really is a study that began to change things for how we think about things in the hospital came out of a group in Belgium where they looked in their ICU. This was primarily people who'd had surgery, but there were some patients who were admitted for medical reasons, pneumonia or severe infection. And they basically took this group and said, let's divide them again into two groups. One group that we're only going to give them insulin if their blood sugar goes above 215. The other group we're going to give them insulin if their blood sugar goes above 110. And we're actually going to try to keep it below 110. That's a pretty strict target compared to what we're used to in the hospital. If you look at the intense group, it's just interesting. That meant that everybody in that group, they were all sick enough to have high blood sugars. They went above 110. 100% of them got insulin versus 40% in the other group. They achieved average blood sugars of about 100 in the intense group versus 150 in the other group. And again, if we look at survival, just making it out of the ICU, what you see in the gray bar is intense treatment and in the blue is conventional treatment. This is survival, so it's the graph is kind of flipped from the red and the blue we saw a moment ago. You want to be up higher. So we see that intense treatment had better survival. And if we look at some other outcomes, this is just a bar that shows mortality, infection, dialysis, blood transfusion, and something called polyneuropathy. It's a change in nerve function that's often seen in ICU patients. And all of those outcomes were reduced by controlling the blood sugar well. They did, that same group came back and said, well, that worked primarily in surgical patients. What about in patients who have more medical illnesses? You get admitted with pneumonia to go to the ICU. And it turns out the difference wasn't quite as striking. On the left side is just all comers, and you can see those two curves really don't show much separation. On the right side is when they analyzed the data, they found out that people that stayed in the ICU for longer than 3 days, you can see that these two curves do begin to separate. So those that got intense treatment had a better survival. If you just look at the numbers, it's only about 60% versus 90% we saw on that last curve. So it's a different group of patients. The hard thing is they couldn't predict who was going to need the ICU for longer than 3 days. So you can't, you kind of have to treat everybody. But again, this suggests that probably controlling blood sugar is important. Last set of data that I'll show you is a group in Portland that does bypass surgery. And this is a little bit different data that we're looking at. They basically came up with the hypothesis that controlling the blood sugar would help with their surgery patients. And they instituted a protocol that helped to keep normal blood sugar levels. And when they started that protocol was in 1990. See if I can get this little pointer to work.
Backwards.
Yep. There we go. So in 1990, and what this shows is the incidence of what's called deep sternal wound infection. If any of you had bypass surgery, they make a saw cut through the middle of the sternum to get to the heart. And unfortunately for some people, they end up with a wound infection there. It's a terrible thing, and it really increases complications. And what you see is before they had this intense protocol, patients with diabetes had a much higher risk of that infection compared to those who didn't. But when they introduced basically a continuous insulin infusion around the time of surgery, you can see that infection rate just gradually dropped down until it was about equal to the other group. And then same thing for mortality. The risk of dying was higher in the diabetes patients. And then after the protocol was started, it came down really to about the same rate as those who didn't have diabetes. Okay. So this would suggest that probably controlling blood sugar in the hospital is important. And there's a lot of talk in the medical literature right now to say, well, gosh, who needs, you know, how intense do we do it? Do you need to have blood sugar of 100 or 150? And is there somebody that benefits from 100 versus 150? And those studies are going to be coming, and that information is still out there. So I'm going to shift gears and try to run through just some principles. So at this point, you may be saying, who cares? This is all lovely, but how does this help me? So if we take a look now, these are just, basically, I'll take you through a couple of general principles, and then we'll look at some specific situations. I think the biggest one that I would really put forth is really to be your own advocate. You know, diabetes is something, as you all know, that relies fairly heavily on self-management. You go see your doctor four times a year, you learn stuff, you see the dietitian, but really day-to-day, it's you who's responsible for your diabetes. And I think the hospital can be scary, because this is a time when basically you're handing over that control. So you know your body, and you're giving it back to a group of people saying, well, I want you to take care of my diabetes. So we'll go through some things. I think if you can, plan ahead. Now, obviously, we can't always know when we're going to go in the hospital, but sometimes we do if we have a surgery coming up or something's happening. I think it's helpful to know really what your blood sugar targets should be. And if you're not reaching your targets, to talk with your doctor about what different can be done. You know, if you're in the hospital and you have 12 things going on, pneumonia and heart failure, and you had a heart attack, and your blood pressure is too high, well, it may be that your doctor is overwhelmed and diabetes is number 10 on the list. And, you know, if your blood sugar is somewhere between 80 and 250, they're okay with that. Well, that may not be the best thing for you. And I think that you can always, if you don't feel like things are going the right way, just go ahead and ask for a diabetes consultation. If you're one of our patients, we'd love to come see you in the hospital. We don't always know when you're here. And we also have a group of skilled physicians in the hospital who works quite a bit with diabetes patients. If you're having surgery, I think talking with your endocrinologist or the person taking care of your diabetes about the surgery. What should I do with my medications before the surgery? What else do I need to know? Do I need any cardiac testing? Am I just ready to go? And I think it's never a bad skill. We'll talk about insulin. I think it's never a bad skill. You may not need it all the time, but never a bad skill to know how to use insulin. Because insulin really works great. If your blood sugar is rapidly fluctuating or shoots way up, it's really great to be able to get control of your blood sugar quickly. When we look at targets, this is based on primarily those studies that we showed. I'm going to show you two groups. This is the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists says we should try to reach a blood sugar target of 110 if you're in the ICU. And if you're just on the hospital ward, regular floor, probably 110 before meals, and it really shouldn't be going above 180, that's primarily after meals. The next one I get to come up is the American Diabetes Association. Again, 110, they put in this phrase, keep it as close to 110 as possible, and generally less than 180 if you're in the ICU, and 90 to 130 on medical surgical floors, and 180 after meals. If you're familiar with the ADA, this is the same targets that they have as outpatient therapy. So they basically said, well, gosh, we should really be shooting for the same level. The data says we want near normal blood sugar. All right, this is a lot of words. It's in your handout. But I think if you're planning surgery, basically we'll look before surgery, during surgery, after surgery, what you can do. If you can, you want to get your blood sugar under control before surgery. If we look at that, again, that intervention data with the angioplasty, we saw that controlling blood sugar that day actually made a difference. Find out if you need cardiac surgery. It's really best if you can have a morning surgery. Most of the time, if you have insulin or medications that drop your blood sugar, if you can have your procedure in the morning, it just makes it easier for you the day of surgery. And so ask if you can have your operation in the morning. Again, talk with us about your plans for medication. I think you want to talk with your anesthesiologist. They're the ones during the operation that are kind of in charge of your diabetes. What do they want you to do? If you have type 1 diabetes, or if you're on insulin and you're having a long or complex surgery, probably getting something called an insulin drip is the right way to go. Not every anesthesiologist will want to do that, or they may not think about it unless you ask them. And then ask what they want you to do. If you happen to have a low blood sugar on that morning of surgery, you know, you're supposed to be not eating. How do they want you to correct it? Do they mind if you take a little bit of juice or the glucose tablet? Most of the time, both of those things are okay. I think if you're on an insulin pump, so you need a plan for either staying on the pump or are you going to come off the pump, and how is that going to happen? Depends on the type of surgery. You also want to remember to bring your supplies and your pump and reservoirs and tubing and all those things so that you can go back onto your pump when you're ready after the surgery. And just be aware that the staff is going to freak out when they see your pump. They're not used to seeing that. Night before surgery, general principles. Usually you're not allowed to eat after midnight. If you're on long-acting insulin, Lantus, usually you can take your full dose or perhaps 80% of your dose if you're taking it at night. I'll just put in a caveat there. If Lantus is your only insulin, or if you're on both short and long-acting insulin, that Lantus is more than 50% of your total dose, you may need a bigger adjustment. Often you'll know that if your blood sugar is dropping more than 40 points overnight, you may need to take a little bit less. I don't know if anyone here is on Levemir. Usually you can take the full dose. In NPH, you can take about the full dose the night before. You can take your usual short-acting insulin with dinner, and pill medicines are generally okay the night before surgery. On the morning of surgery, if you happen to take your Lantus in the morning, again, same thing. You usually can take your full dose of Lantus, but may need that same adjustment we talked about. Levemir and NPH, usually you're cutting back to about half to two-thirds of your dose, because those insulins do have a peak that happens in the middle of the day. And if you're not eating, we don't want the blood sugar to drop low. Rapid or short-acting insulin, obviously, if you're not eating, we don't usually have you take your Humalog or your Novolog or your Apidra or your regular insulin. But you can give what's called the correction dose, or the vernacular sliding scale, if your blood sugar is high. Pill medicines, I won't go through them all. What you'll see on this list is that by and large, we mostly hold them. I mean, there's a few that may be given. Metformin, Avandia, Actos usually don't help you. If you miss one dose, it doesn't change things too much. Sulfonylureas can drop your blood sugar low. We don't usually give those. The rest of the medications, including Byetta and the new DPP-4 inhibitors, which Dr. Kamath will talk about, there's probably no reason to give those that on that morning. And then you'll want to ask your anesthesiologist about your non-diabetic medications. They may have you stop aspirin, for example, for a week before surgery. But it's usually okay to take those for your blood pressure or whatnot. But ask your anesthesiologist or your surgeon what they want you to do. And then in general, you're going to want to monitor your blood sugar every 2 to 3 hours until the time of surgery. Now, some of this depends on your individual situation. If you're on no medications and your blood sugar is always 100 when you check it, well, it's not going to change too much that morning. But if you're a type 1, you're on an insulin pump, you're going to want to know what your blood sugar is. And most of us probably fall somewhere in between. It's okay to use your rapid-acting insulin to correct a high blood sugar. Okay to use blood sugar tablets, table sugar, or small amounts of juice to correct a low blood sugar. But again, this is where it's nice to have talked with your anesthesiologist beforehand, just so they know, or you know, what they prefer, so you don't show up and say, well, my blood sugar was 40 and I had 4 ounces of juice, and they say, well, sorry, you can't have your surgery today. And if you do end up taking something, just make sure they know what it was. During surgery, you're asleep. After surgery, we'll come to some hospital notes. If you go home, what I'll tell you is that blood sugars often run high after surgery just due to that stress. So you may need medication adjustment, you may need an insulin adjustment, or potentially you may need to start insulin if you weren't on insulin before. That's where it's nice to know how to use it. Usually for the first 1 or 2 days, you're going to just want to treat that like a sick day. Your blood sugar may be a little bit unpredictable. You're going to want to increase your monitoring. You may want to increase your fluid intake. If you're used to checking ketones, so you have type 1 diabetes primarily, you may or probably want to be checking ketones periodically, particularly if your blood sugar is running above 250. And you want to call your diabetes doctor if your blood sugar is doing something funny. And then I put this down here. If we looked at that data, don't be afraid of insulin. Like I say, insulin has a great role for controlling blood sugar. I think a lot of people really feel like once they start on insulin, that's the end, and it's just all downhill from there. And we know that that's not true. Controlling the blood sugar decreases the risk of complications. And after surgery, quite commonly, we find it's needed only for a few days to weeks until that stress is gone and the body recovers. If you're in the hospital, all I say is that the regimen to control your blood sugar is highly variable. Pill medicines may work, often insulin is needed. Typically, most people should be getting their blood sugar monitored at least before meals and at bedtime, or every 4 to 6 hours if you're not eating. Insulin is usually given in a combination of long-acting and short-acting insulin, and often what's called a correction dose. to correct a high blood sugar if that happens. If the only thing that you have written by your doctor is the correction dose or so-called sliding scale, often you'll see the blood sugar is quite variable and will yo-yo a little bit. It's okay, again, to ask your doctor if there's a different way to do things to help prevent that blood sugar from getting high. This goal is kind of a subset of be your own advocate. If you're taking insulin and are fairly skilled with it, so this is typically people who are on multiple insulin doses, maybe you're counting carbohydrates, ask if you can just take care of your own diabetes. You have to be awake and sharp. So if you're just coming out of anesthesia and you've got some morphine on board and some anesthetic, well, that's not the time that you want to make this transition. But the day after, if you're sort of back and awake and you know your body, chances are that you will do as well, if not better, than most of the doctors or nurses in terms of picking your own insulin or matching it to your food intake. And this is something that often this isn't thought about, but it works really well for a lot of people. And then with that, use your diabetes doctor to help you make adjustments. So you may know your body, but this is a new situation for you. Your blood sugar may run a little bit different. So again, if you're on a pump, you may need to run a temporary basal at an increased rate, or may need to change your carbohydrate ratio. After you go home, stay in contact with your healthcare team. Again, we talked about monitoring. Monitoring for sick day. This is basically the same stuff we just went through. And just remember that blood sugar levels after you go home are important. We saw that data that controlling blood sugar can help to decrease the risk of complications. So this is Ryan, he's 2 weeks old, Maddie is 4. With that, I'm sorry to make that go through so fast, but I'm going to stop there. And perhaps, I think because we're in the interest of time, maybe what I'll do is take just 2 questions, and then we'll transition to the next speaker.
Doctor, what research has been done on the pre-surgery stress that most patients go through? You mentioned the post-surgery stress, particularly to use insulin as a corrective measure. What about the prior to surgery? What studies have shown? What is the increase in glucose levels, et cetera?
So if people could hear the question, it was what about the pre-surgery stress? So I assume by the question you mean that often your physiologic situation is different immediately before the surgery.
Well, you're apprehensive and you can...
Sure. It's an excellent question. As far as I know, no one has looked at that specifically. But presumably, from everything that we know, I would extrapolate and say that if your blood sugar runs high, that controlling that blood sugar is probably beneficial. But there's no outcome data or science that I'm aware of that's actually looked at that in a scientific fashion. And then there was, I saw one in the back over here.
Me?
Yes, sir.
I have a comment. The period of time when you're not eating is often 12 hours, or some of them even more.
Yes.
And so I recommend an early morning surgery so that it's more in line with what you're normally doing anyway. If you wait till like noon or 2 o'clock, you can really get messed up trying to control yourself. I'm talking about type one.
Well, and I think that's true. And that's if you look on that pre-surgery planning, that was, we went through it really fast, but that was on that list to ask for the morning surgery.
But that's kind of a difficult area for diabetics to manage. Maybe you could expand on that somewhere.
Yeah, so if people heard the comment again, I think was just reiterating that it's helpful to have that morning surgery. And I would agree, when you're not eating, the shorter you can keep that interval, the easier it is to manage your blood sugar. Your surgeon often can accommodate that, sometimes they can't. And that's where I think using your healthcare team to help you make a plan, if you are waiting till 2 o'clock to have your surgery, to have some plan as to how you're gonna deal with your blood sugar during that time. Let me stop there, and I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Sternholm.